birthday. This is wonderful. You're 29, aren't you? Gosh, that's wonderful. You were 2 years old when I came into this program. Such a wonderful, wonderful thing. I'm so grateful that I was invited to come up here and share my life with you. Let me start by introducing myself. My name is Ellen Florenz, and I'm a very grateful member of the Preston Al-Anon Family Group in Big D. Hey. Hi. You know, when I first came into the program, and I was following my sponsor everywhere, she talked in at an anniversary in Tyler, Texas, and there was a saying somewhere that actually is very much what has happened to me since I landed in Omaha. And the saying was that there are no strangers here, only friends that we haven't met yet. And that's how I feel about you. That's how I feel. I want to thank you, the committee, for, again, inviting me, and also for the wonderful basket of goodies that was in the room. I just love to munch late at night. Our literature suggests that when we share, that we do so by sharing what it was like, what happened to change it, and what it is like today. My it was my life. In a nutshell, before the program, my life was filled with darkness and despair. What happened to change that is nothing short of a miracle. And what my life is like today is an adventure. Now, some adventures take me to really, really, really neat places. And other adventures, I would just give anything not to have to go through them. But I have the tools of this program that you people and the people that went before all of us handed down to us. And I can live life today rather than endure it. I was born in Hartford, Connecticut, the last of two children. I have one sister that is 4 years my senior. When I was 4 years old, we moved to a small town on Long Island. It was a very small community, and everybody knew everybody in that little town. We moved into a very big home that had been converted to a two-family dwelling prior to the turn of the last century. My mother, dad, sister, and I lived upstairs. My paternal grandmother, aunt, uncle, and two cousins lived downstairs. And I'm sure that if I were to go back there and ask the people in that little town what their impression of us was, I'm sure that they would say, oh, you were a very, very happy, loving family. And maybe they were. I don't know. From my earliest remembrances, I always felt as though I didn't belong. I just didn't fit. I always felt as though I was on the outside looking in. And I so desperately wanted to be part of, and I felt apart from, until I found you people. This is where I belong. When I was 6 years old, I entered parochial school, where I learned my very first conception of a deity. And I'm very happy to tell you today that I no longer have that conception. When I was 11 years old, I was told that my mother was terminally ill. And I just knew that if I prayed diligently enough, went to Mass and Communion, did all the First Fridays, did all the Novenas and all the Rosaries, at the very last minute, God would heal her. And I knew that this was going to happen. So as 18 months progressed and everybody became more remote, more morose, I became more jubilant because I knew, I had a secret. I knew that she was going to be healed. And on June 17th of 1957, when she passed away, I could not have been more shocked than had she gone to the store and never come home. I was truly traumatized. At that time, there were very wonderful people around me, meaning very well, telling me that, well, God needed her more in heaven. And I remember thinking, well, if that's the kind of a God you are, I don't want anything to do with you. You know, I need her, and you took her. So I turned my back on God at that point in my life. I was 13 years old, and I swore that I would never look at him again. But of course, in a Catholic Irish family, you don't let anybody else know that. So I began to play the game, and I truly believe that that is when the soul sickness that the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about took hold in my life. I began playing the game. I need you to love me, and I will do anything for you to love me. And the game that we played in my family was, if you love me, you will know what I want you to do, and then you will do it. Now, I never mastered that. I tried to figure out what people wanted me to do, and it never worked. I was playing that game when I got here to you people. And I don't play that anymore. And I'm so grateful for that. When I was 16, a friend of mine called me one Saturday night and asked me if I would agree to go on a blind date the next day. It seems as though there were a bunch of kids going to the beach, and her friend wanted to go, but her boyfriend didn't have a car. However, he had a brother that had a car but didn't have a girl, so would I be the girl that went with the guy that had the car so they could go? So I said, well, sure. And I remember I met them at a central point in town. It was the Lawrence Cedarhurst Fire Department, and it was 1 o'clock in the afternoon on April 29th, and I don't know what year. And this green Oldsmobile pulled up, and this man got out of the car. He was 18 years old, 6 foot tall, dark hair, eyes the color of these chairs. And when he got out of that car, the ground shook. And I remember looking at him thinking, oh, I do believe one of these days I am going to marry you. Nothing impulsive about me at all. So we went to the beach. Now, I was the only one that had a bathing suit and a towel. Apparently, they were not planning on going swimming. They said, oh, you can just leave that bathing suit in the car. And I remember thinking, oh, my Lord, what have I gotten myself into? So we went down, and we went down to the boardwalk, and they made a right turn, and then they made another right turn into this dive that was on the boardwalk. And I remember walking in there. The smoke, you could have cut it with a knife. The neon lights were way across the room. You could barely see them. And it smelled funny in there. And I remember thinking to myself, this is a side of life that I have yet to experience. And, of course, it was a bar. Now, had I been a little more astute, a little more streetwise, I may have gotten the message. Because the name of that bar is Dirty Dicks. Now, I want you to know that I talked in Amarillo a couple of years ago, and there was one guy that just ran up to see me afterward, and he said, you know, it's still there. Dirty Dicks in Long Beach, they're still there. Well, we started going out, and we did what kids did in those days. We started going steady. And then when I got out of high school, I did not want to go to school anymore. I had had enough of the Josephites, and I didn't want to continue an education. And in those days, you either went to college or you got married. That's what you did. So I decided, well, you know, we'll just go ahead and get married. So at the old age of 19, of course, I knew everything. I knew how to settle every problem in the world when I was 19. So we decided to get married, so we did. I started playing house. I would have the dinner on the table at 5 o'clock every night when he was due home. And the dinner would sit there until 7:30. By 9 o'clock, I am pacing across the living room floor, wringing the skin right off my hands, begging this God that I want nothing to do with, please don't take him out of my life. He is the only person that loves me. Pardon me. And long about, oh, I guess for the next 3 hours, I would press my nose against the icy windows of the January snow outside, waiting for him to come home. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, I would see the car come down West Broadway and turn into the parking lot of the home that we lived in. Now, there are a lot of two-family dwellings up there in New York, and we lived on the second floor. Now, being newlyweds, we did not have enough funds to carpet the entire place. We had these beautiful hardwood floors. When I saw his car come in the driveway, I was so relieved. Oh, thank you, God, that you brought him home. And then he was trying to come up the stairs. You know, he had a trouble finding each step. And when he got to the second floor landing, he couldn't seem to get the key in the door. So I remember opening the door. All I wanted to do was just take him in my arms and just tell him how much I love him and how grateful I was that he was still alive. And I opened the door, and when I opened the door, something happened to me, and I went from, oh, I'm so grateful you're here, to trying to kill him with my bare hands. Now, we would have these knockdown, drag-out fights on these beautiful hardwood floors, directly over the bedroom of these people downstairs. I still owe them amends, if I ever see them. Now, the 12 and 12 says that the definition of insanity is meeting a familiar situation with the same action and expecting different results. Well, what did I know? My family told me, honey, you can have anything in this world that you want, but you have to work for it. So I just knew that if I made his life miserable enough, he would shape up and come home. So this scene was repeated night after night, week after week, month after month, year after year. And I was just hard at it. Suddenly, I started crying a lot. And I would go to my family and I would say, you know, he doesn't come home at night. How come? And they would say, well, you know, your mother was a wonderful woman. And I never drank. That's what my father would say. And that makes sense to me in those days. But it doesn't make sense to me anymore, because I know about the disease of alcoholism, and I know about the family disease of alcoholism. I began to suffer from what I was to later discover in these rooms was an obsession. I would open my eyes in the morning, and before my feet would hit the ground, I would wonder, is he going to go to work? If he does, will he stay there? If he doesn't stay there, where will he go, who will he be with, and what are they going to be doing? Now, these thoughts permeated my mind so that I was unable to perform the task that I was employed to do. So, as a result, I was fired from job after job after job after job after job. One year, I had 18 W-2 forms to attach to my, don't tell me this disease isn't catching. 18. So I got a brilliant idea one time, and I thought, well, you know, there's one job that I can never get fired from, even though 15 years down the road, I would have given you anything if you fired me from it, and that was motherhood. So 9 months after I got this beautiful idea, our first precious, and I do mean precious, daughter was born. She was wonderful. And I just knew that if he wouldn't come home to me, surely he would come home to this precious baby girl. Well, he didn't. So, you know, if one's good, two's better. So, 16 months later, our second precious little baby girl was born. And I do want you to know I love them dearly, but I will be grateful until the day I die that I got the message after two. Because, you see, I am not a quitter. And neither was my sister-in-law, whose husband did all of the drinking with my husband. She has 14 children. Thank you, God, that I quit something. So after my last child was born, I cried all the time. And people said to me, you know, Ellen, you should really go and talk to somebody. So I did. And I walked in there and I said to him, I'm not happy. And he said, I can tell. But I have something that will make you happier. So at the ripe old age of 24, I found myself behind the locked doors of a psychiatric unit going through a series of electroshock therapy. You see, In those days, they didn't know about the family disease of alcoholism. And they didn't know what to do with people like you and me, because it wasn't out in the open as it is today. I'm so glad that they don't do that today. When I came through that experience, I made a vow to myself, and for all of you Catholics in here, you know how serious that is. I made a vow to myself that if I ever felt as though I was losing it again, that I would simply end my life. And I was very, very, very comfortable with that. Now, he got the message after that little stint in the hospital, and he came home. He came home and he drank at home. He was a very happy, loving, quiet little drunk. He would just sit in the chair and be absent, you know? Now, years in this program, I wondered, why was it okay for him not to be there intellectually or emotionally or spiritually, but just have his body there? Why was that okay? And it wasn't okay when he was out. And the answer was because the car was in the driveway and all of the neighbors would think that we were a happy, loving family. It was what people thought was so astronomically important to me in those days. We knew what the problem in our marriage was after I came out of the hospital. We had to buy a house, so we bought a house. And then 8 months later, the marriage was going down the tubes again, and we realized, well, the cure for this is to get a bigger house. So we sold that house. Does that sound familiar? We sold that house and moved into a bigger house. Now, after we moved into the second home, our children became quite ill, physically, as well as mentally and emotionally and spiritually. Those poor kids were born into insanity. They truly were. As I said, he was a very happy-go-lucky drunk, and I was crazy. I was the violent one in the home. It was me. I'm not proud of it, but that's the way it was. I remember during the stay of my youngest daughter for kidney problems, I met the mother of a little boy in the room across the hall. He was 8 years old and Diane was 5. And I walked in, laden down with presents one evening to see my daughter, and Mary was sitting there. And she said, you know, is your husband coming? And I said, my husband? My husband come to see his poor, suffering child? Let me tell you about my husband. And she said, why don't we let the children play, and why don't you and I go down and have a cup of coffee? Does that sound familiar? We went down, and she bought me a cup of coffee. And I talked, and she listened. I talked, and she listened, and she listened, and she listened, and she listened. Nobody had ever listened to me before. Nobody. Not even when I paid them to. And Mary told me that she was a member of Al-Anon and that her husband George was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and would I like to come to a meeting. I told her that I knew Al-Anon was a wonderful organization. I had never heard of you. But I did not know a single solitary alcoholic in the entire world. And I did not feel as though I had the right to infringe upon the privacy of you poor, suffering people. Now, my maiden name is Casey. And I come from a long line of Irish people. Do you know what the Irish produce? They produce drunks, clergy, and policemen, in that order. So, Mary talked to me every day for 3 years. She fed me this program with an eyedropper, and I'm so grateful. If any of you are working with someone that cannot hear you, please don't let go of them, because they may die. Mary did not let go of me, and I'm so grateful to her for that. The only person that I could hear the word alcoholism from was the man I was married to. Mary and George became our closest friends. And in 1973, we figured out what the real problem in the marriage was, and it was that god-awful New York. Good Lord, anybody'd have to drink in order to live in New York. So we decided to move to Texas and buy a ranch. So I remember I stayed behind to sell the house, and my husband flew down to Dallas, and he would come home on the weekends. And this was December 1973. I was watching the Andy Williams Christmas show. That was my 1 hour out of the entire year that I lived for, because I could see a normal family. Everybody loved each other. The dogs and the cats got along. The children got along. The in-laws got along. Everybody just loved each other. So I'm sitting on my end of the sofa watching Andy Williams, and he's sitting on his end of the sofa doing what was normal for an active alcoholic, and that is drinking. And when he drank, he got gabby. And when he drank, he got amorous. And I'm trying to watch my show that I waited a whole year to see. So he starts invading my section of the sofa. And then I hear sweet nothings being whispered in my ear. And I suddenly found myself in the middle of the living room floor, and I heard me say to him, "If you ever touch me again after you have been drinking, I'll kill you." I said it just that way. I did not know that I was going to say that. I did not know that that's how I felt. But when I heard those words come out of my mouth, I knew that I was prepared to do it. I was prepared. And I uttered that prayer that I think all of us utter at one point or another before we get here. And I said, "Oh God, help us. Get him out of here, or there's going to be bloodshed." He got insulted and went down the hall, and I just turned around and sat down and started watching good old Andy again. And then about 10 minutes later, he started coming down the hall in a crooked fashion, and he sat down in the middle of the living room floor, and he said to me, "Ellen, I think I'm an alcoholic and I need to go to AA." Now, I cannot tell you what that did to me. Those words went straight into my knower. And my knower said, "Yes, you are. And you need to go to Al-Anon, Ellen." And then my thinker caught up with what my knower just said. And my thinker said, "Oh, no, he's not alcoholic. Now, what would people think? He's not alcoholic. He just needs to cut down a little bit in his drinking so that we'll have more money and everything will be..." You know what? It didn't work, because I knew. I knew he was alcoholic. And once you know, you cannot ever not know again. It's impossible. You can try to forget by running away into sex, drugs, food, whatever. But you can never go back to the place that you were at before you knew. And I knew that he was alcoholic. Of course, when he woke up the next morning, he was sober and he wasn't alcoholic anymore, you understand. However, I knew. And I went to my very first Al-Anon meeting in the basement of a church on December 23rd, 1973. I had no idea what you all were talking about. No idea. There are two things that I remember about that meeting. I remember the softness of the speaker's voice. And I remember her eyes, the peace and the gentleness. After the meeting, people were hugging each other, and they were laughing. You know, I hadn't laughed in years. And here I was amidst people that were laughing. And nobody had hugged me in years unless they wanted something. Nobody. I had no idea what you were all about, but I do know that when I went to that first meeting, something happened inside of me. It was truly a feeling. And I remember feeling it, thinking, "Oh my Lord, what is that?" I can tell you today what that was. It was hope that I lost many years before I got here. I was truly hopeless when I found you people. When I went to Al-Anon, I attended three meetings every day for the first 3.5 months that I was in this program. I know in AA they suggest that you go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and I tripled that. Why did I triple that? Because when I came in here, I was dying. And knowing what I know about me today, about the condition I was in when I got here, I can tell you I would not have gone alone. I would not have left this earth alone. Now, not everybody comes into Al-Anon in the same shape that I was in. When I tell you that I was dying, I can tell you exactly what I was dying from. Spiritual, mental, emotional, and somewhat from physical isolation, as well as futility and despair. These are not things that they write on death certificates, but these are indeed states of being that precede directly acts such as murder and or suicide, of which I was totally capable. And I am so grateful that I got to this program. I'm so grateful. The person that I tell you about here tonight doesn't live here anymore. It's as though I'm telling you about an old acquaintance that I used to have at one point in my life. We moved down here to Texas, and I got involved in Al-Anon. About 11 months after I came into the program, my husband, well, he stopped drinking on December 24th of 1973 and dabbled and played with AA for a while. But 11 months later, he hit his own bottom without drinking again. And he went into AA, and he has been a sober and active member of Alcoholics Anonymous since then. And he has just celebrated 27 years of sobriety. And that's his miracle. You know, I'm so happy for him. We are no longer married. I do want to let you know that neither AA nor Al-Anon is in the marriage business. We are not here to create marriages. We are not here to destroy marriages. We are not here to save marriages. We are here to save lives. And my life and his life and the lives of my children were all saved. The marriage wasn't. And that's just the way it was. I think the true miracles in this program are those that come in and stay married and both grow together. And I think that's wonderful. And I applaud that. And I would like to have had something like that in my life. When I came into this program, I found my sponsor at the Preston Al-Anon Group. Oh, my goodness. And she pointed me toward the steps. And I had to look at my life. And I had to say that I was truly powerless over alcohol. And I didn't understand why I had to say that. Because I had more of a problem with Coca-Cola. You know, I mean, I didn't drink. He drank. So why am I powerless? I understand today that I'm powerless over anything that people drink or smoke or snort or do whatever. I'm powerless over everything. Even with my children, I was powerless the minute they cut that umbilical cord. And you see, I didn't know that until I got here. And my life truly was unmanageable. I remember talking to my sponsor and saying, you know, there's nothing in this world that I want more than to be relieved of this rage. Now, I was, as I said, I was a rageaholic. I truly was. I was the one who the children came in to see if I was home before they brought any people over, any kids over to play. I was the one that our 85-pound Labrador Retriever took a look at, saw me come through the door, ran down the steps, and tried to crawl under the bed. That was me. I was the one that was screaming and carrying on and destroying everything. I was the one. Am I proud of that? No. No. That was a symptom of the family disease that I was infected with. And when I got to this program, I wanted that removed. And my sponsor said to me, Ellen, what happens to you when you go into these rages? And I said, well, it's kind of like I see the storm on the horizon, and then it's gone, and then there's all this destruction in the middle. I think they call that temporary insanity in the court. And she said, well, the next time you feel that, what I want you to do is put everything down and go for a ride. So a couple of nights later, Wonder Boy came home. And I call him Wonder Boy because I used to look at him and say, I wonder. Anyway, he kicked something out of the middle of the living room floor. And I just started feeling this gut clutch, you know. So I put everything down and I got in the car and I hit I-35. And by the time I was on I-35, I am screaming and yelling and cursing and pounding the dashboard and just throwing the biggest hissy fit you can imagine. But you know, I did it differently. I did not endanger my family. I only endangered everybody else on the road. But I did it differently. You know, I did it differently. They said to me, Ellen, if you're happy with the results in your life that you have today, don't change a thing. But if you want different results, you must do life differently. And I did that differently. I couldn't stop the hissy fit, but I did it differently. And she had told me, just go for a ride and don't turn around until you feel better. So by the time I felt better, I was in Oklahoma. I passed the Arbuckle Mountains, and I was in Davis, Oklahoma, halfway to Kansas. But I felt better, and I remember I turned around, and I went home, and I went in, and he kind of looked at me like, well, she finally slipped a cog. And I sat down, and I said to him, I said, you know, I want you to know that I'm in this program, and there is absolutely nothing in this world more important to me than recovering. Not you, not the children, not the horse. Not the horse, not the pony, not the pig, or not the cow. See, we bought a ranch. We were coming down here to... Where was my brain? We were coming down to Texas to buy a ranch. I don't know what century I thought I was deplaning in, but it was very cosmopolitan when I got there. And I told him, you know, there's nothing more important, and I want you to know if I ever feel as though I'm getting upset again, I'm going to leave. And I went to bed that night, and I slept the sleep of an infant. You know, I had victory for the very first time in my entire life over that rage. I am very grateful to tell you today that that rage has been completely removed from my life. That alone is a miracle. That alone. I came in here and then I, step two says that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I had a real problem with that because it had that word sanity in it. And you know, people had told me on a regular basis that I didn't have both oars in the water. And here I come into this program and you all are telling me that too. And I remember saying to people, listen, I have papers to prove that I'm sane. They let me out. Where are yours? I am not insane. And somebody invited me to go to the dictionary and look the word up, which I did, and I found the definition to be sound thinking. And I realized at that time that the reactions that I was engaging in were not those of a person who was thinking very soundly. And that brought me to step three, where it said that we came... No, what is step three? Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. And when I got to step three, I didn't understand anything. I didn't understand how to do it. How do you do step three? I would go to people and say, how do you do it? And they said, well, you just turn it over. And I would say, how do you turn it over? And they would say, well, you let go. Well, how do you let go? Well, you just turn it over. I mean, I couldn't get anybody to tell me, how do I do this third step? And I found this prayer that says, my God, I offer myself to Thee to build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Release me from the bondage of self that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, so that victory over them will bear witness to those I would help of your power, your love, and your way of life. May I do thy will always. As I got on my knees with that prayer, I saw me in my mind's eye emerging from a medieval dungeon. and I was thoroughly wrapped in chains like a mummy, like a mummy. And I went over that prayer again. And as I went over it again, I thought about it. And I said, yes, here I am, God. I do offer all of me to you, everything that I know, everything that I have, every experience, and all that there is to come. I offer to you. Please take it. And please build me and mold me and groom me into the person that you wanted me to be when you formed me in my mother's womb. I asked him to take away my difficulties. Why? Because I was tired of messing with them? Because I had been handling them all my life? No, that's not why I asked him to take away my difficulties, and that's not what that prayer says. It says, please take away my difficulties so that when I experience the victory over them, it will bear witness to other people of your power and your love and your way of life. May I do thy will always. I got up from that prayer and I began my fourth step. I wrote my life in an autobiographical form, breaking it down into seven-year segments. I asked God, as I was on my knees, to fill my mind with everything he wanted me to know, and I promised him that I would write whatever he put in my mind. And I did. It took me 8 hours solid one day, and at the end of those 8 hours, I felt as though I had been run over by a fleet of 18-wheelers. And I called my sponsor and I said, I have got to get rid of this stuff. I haven't finished it, but I can't go on. I've got to get rid of this. The next day, we met. And I took my very first fifth step. And I do say fifth step because I have done many and will continue to do many. It's called a house cleaning step. I wish that I only had to clean my house once in a lifetime. But you know what? It gets dusty. And people live there. And fingerprints start appearing on doors. So I have to clean my house more than once in my lifetime. And I have to clean my emotional and spiritual house also more than once. As I was in that first fifth step, miracles began to happen to me. I became acquainted for the very first time in my life with Ellen. Prior to coming into this program, one of my tries at saving everything was to see a psychologist who told me that I was a non-entity. Oh, I was so insulted. I said, I know who I am. I'm his wife, their daughter, their mother, their neighbor. This is who I am. In the midst of my fifth step, and I became acquainted with me, I knew exactly what he had been saying to me. And he could not have been more right. Had you taken me and put me in the middle of an island somewhere in the Pacific, I would not have been able to tell you anything about Ellen. After that first fifth step, I became aware of defects of character, behavior patterns that I had used all of my life, that I no longer wanted to allow to flourish and grow in the garden of my life. But I became aware of assets that I had no idea that I had. I had no idea. And for me, that's what an inventory was, looking at all of it and seeing the good, the positive, and the negative, and getting rid of what I didn't want anymore. One of the miracles that happened in that first fifth step is that I became aware of this word that we throw around in this program, and not everybody knows what it means, and it's the word humility. And I found the definition of it in the 12 and 12 in step 5. It says that humility is a clear recognition of who and what we have become, followed by a sincere attempt to become all that we can be. And that happened to me in my first fifth step. Then I was ready for step 6. And I just knew that now that I did this fourth and fifth step, I would never throw another hissy fit. I just knew that. And I went home, and probably 47 seconds later, I'm bouncing off the wall. And I just knew, well, I'm not trying to control myself enough. So I exercised a lot of that control, and finally I called a friend of mine and I said, Mary Alex, this program doesn't work. And she said, oh, tell me what doesn't work. So I told her. And she said, go get your 12 and 12. Step 6 says, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. So she said to me, I want you to read that step again. So I did. We're entirely ready to have God. She said, stop right there. She said, who does it say is going to do the removing? And I said, oh, we're entirely ready to have God remove. Oh, so God's going to do this. And she said, yes. However, there is a part that you play. And I said, oh, and what is that? So she said, read the step again. We're entirely ready. And she said, stop right there. And she said, Ellen, are you entirely ready not to have your own way? No. I wasn't. Oh, I wanted to say yes so bad. So badly. But I wasn't. And I started crying and I said to her, I said, Mary Alex, I said, I want a good family. I want us to love each other. I want the children to feel secure. I want my husband to love me. I want to love him. And I want us to get along. And she said, these are very good things to want. She said, however, you want it so badly that you have a death grip on it. And she was right, because I just wanted him to shape up. You know, I wanted this one to do this and this one to do this, and I wanted him to shape up so we could all be happy. And I had to let go of what I wanted. I had to start praying for God's will for my life. Step 7 came right after step 6, where I humbly asked him to remove my shortcomings. And that brought me to step 8, where I had the list of all of the people that I had harmed and needed to become willing to make amends to them all. There was one person on that list that I absolutely refused to make amends to, and that was my dad. Anytime my sponsor suggested that I might look at that area, I just said, no, I don't owe him anything. And she said, okay. She's very loving and very nurturing. She really is. And she just kind of lets me have the rope until I can't breathe anymore. And then she says, well, let's talk. And one of those situations had occurred, and my dad called me. And when I got off the phone, I was just ballistic. And she said, you might want to take a look at that. So I did. And she said, you know, she said, in this program, we learn to pray for what we don't have. And there's not anywhere that you can go to buy a little box of willingness. So I would suggest that you get on your knees morning and night and ask God for the willingness that you need to do what you need to do. Chapter 5 says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. It doesn't say, rarely have we seen a person fail who has gone as far as they want to go, or proceeded until it got uncomfortable. You know, you don't have to like what you have to do in this program in order to recover. All you have to do is do it. It doesn't have to feel good. It doesn't have to be pleasant. But if you want to get well, you must do it. So I got on my knees. And the only way that I could, I had my fists clenched, I had my teeth gritted, and I said, well, I'm here. And I know that I have to ask you for the willingness to make these amends to my father, and I said, but I know I have to do that, and I'm doing it. And at the end of everything, I said, and I didn't mean a word of it, and I got up. But you know, that's all I could do. That's all I could do. And I did that at night, and I did it the next day, and I kept doing it. And I realized as time went on that I was no longer gritting my teeth, and I was no longer clenching my fists. And one day, the miracle overtook me. See, I truly believe in this program that if I pray for God's will, in line with God's will, that miracles happen. And one day this miracle overtook me, and I had this urge to go see my dad in California and make amends to him. I did. Now, I did not go over to him and say, you know, Dad, all of my life I've hated you with a dripping purple passion. And I'm in this program now, and they tell me I can't do that. I did not say that. I would urge anybody that's interested in doing their amends that they check with a sponsor first. I went out there, and I merely allowed him to be who he was. I did not fight with him. I did not argue with him. I did not try to change him. When I got on the plane to come to go home, I was free. I was free. I'm very grateful that I was able to do that, because a month and a half later, I was called back to California because my father was dying of cancer. I had an hour with him in the hospital where the two of us met as fellow travelers on this road called life. I asked him how he was doing, and he said, I'm fine. He said, but I want to know how you are. He was interested in me and who I am. I left, and of course I went back 2 weeks later for his funeral. Now, when I went back to California, there was a lot of grief. There was a lot of sadness. There were a lot of tears. But there was no guilt. There was no if only. Because I had. Because I did what I was told was necessary for me to recover. How do you fit 27 years into 60 minutes? You know? I want to share with you something that happened, I guess about 10, 12 years ago. I was running into a store. I was literally running into a store to see if they had a sale on coffee. And I fell on a curb this big and almost killed myself. They took me away in an ambulance, and I wound up with a cast on my left leg and nerve damage on the top of my right foot. But something much deeper happened to me when I fell, and that's another story. I remember I was sitting in my wheelchair at home, and a friend called and said, would you like to go to church? Now, I hadn't been in church in a long time. And I thought, well, yeah, why not? I'm not going dancing. I may as well. So she picked me up, wheelchair and all, and we went to this church on this Wednesday night. And this was a Baptist church. And I had never been to a Baptist church. And you know they eat dinner on Wednesday nights before the service? Did you know that? They cook. And it was good. It was really good. Anyway, I'm sitting in this wheelchair. And at the average age of the congregation was 67. I was the only one there that had brown hair. Oh, I forgot to tell you. My husband and I got divorced in 1976. I don't want to forget that. Lest you think I'm a bigamist. And I'm sitting in my wheelchair, and this man walked in. And he had brown hair. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and right there in the middle of church, in front of God and everybody, I fell in something. And that something that I fell in was not spiritual. And we started seeing each other. And I knew he was wonderful. You know, I met him in church. Gosh, he didn't drink. He didn't smoke those funny little cigarettes. He didn't swallow anything to feel better. And he really loved God. Oh, this is wonderful. So we decided to get married. Now, I knew him 3 months. And we decided to get married. I had been in the program at this time 16 years. And I had been doing a lot of talking in the Dallas area, and I had done a lot of work on me. This is for all of you long-timers in here. Sit up straight and listen. I did not feel it necessary to discuss this life-changing decision with anyone, least of all my sponsor. So, what did I do? I just called and announced, I'm getting married. And guys, I'm from New York, and I know how to say something. Delivering the message, don't even go there. And people just said, oh, my goodness, I didn't even know you were seeing anyone. So we got married, and it was absolutely the best Well, it was wonderful. It was everything that I knew marriage was all about. He loved me, I loved him, and it was wonderful for 7 weeks. After 7 weeks, I said, oh my God, Ellen, what have you done? But not being a quitter, I hung in there for another year. My endurance has lessened, thank God. So a year later, I decided, well, you know, I had enough of you, so, you know, I went down and filed suit for divorce. And anyway, my daughter, my youngest daughter, had come over right during that time. And you see, he had this filing cabinet that he brought into the marital arrangements. And I remember after the first 7 weeks looking at that filing cabinet, and I said, I wonder what's in that filing cabinet. And this little voice over here said, Ellen, you can't do that. You can't look in there. That's an invasion of privacy. You see, I wasn't through. A year later, I said, where is that filing cabinet? See, I was finished. Kind of like a Thanksgiving turkey that goes, bing, when you're finished, you know, and when you're finished, it's all done. So I was finished. Now, this is for all of you snoopers in here. Now, how do I know there are snoopers in this room? This is an Al-Anon meeting, isn't it? So I opened this filing cabinet, and I found all of this stuff. And I said to Diane, I said, oh, my Lord, what is all of this stuff? And she said, I don't know, Mom. So I took this stuff, and I gave it to a friend of mine who lives in another city, and she gave it to a friend of hers who happens to be an inspector in one of the local police departments. And he came back to her, and he said, oh, you know this guy? This guy right here? Yeah, well, that's not his name. This is his name. And there are lots of people looking for him all over the country. And she called me and she said, sit down. And she told me his name. And I said, what's his name? And he has finally come to be known as what's his name. See, I have a wonderful name, what's his name? And I called my attorney and I said, what does this mean? And he said, oh, well, it just means that you were never really married. You were never really married because, you were married under fraudulent circumstances. However, since you have been living together in the state of Texas as man and wife for longer than 6 months, you are married under the common law of the state of me, a Catholic school graduate, pure as the driven snow. Married, common law. And you know, I had a very interesting conversation with somebody here, and I said, I was a good girl. And you know what? I wasn't a good girl. I was scared to death to do anything wrong. You know? And I said, well, whatever. Just get me out of this. He called me about 2 months after that. And I said, you know, I'm so glad you called. Oh, I left the most important thing out. I believe that marriage is very sacred, and I believe that marriage is a covenant. And in a covenant, everything that I have is yours, and everything that you have is mine. And he believed this, sort of. He believed that everything that I had was his, and everything that he had was his. And when I went to the bank, everything that I had in this world was gone. Everything. I had nothing left. I felt as though I had been raped. Spiritually, mentally, emotionally, and financially and physically. That's how I felt after 16 years in this program. And I began to hang on to the hand of God like I never had before. I have a neurological condition that cropped up when I was 8 years old. And after I married him, I was having symptoms of it again. And in order not to have this progress any further, I quit work. So when I discovered that I really wasn't married to what's-his-name, I had to, you know, go out and get a job. I was no longer 28. I have never been long-legged, and I wasn't blonde at the time. Now, I tried to find a job for a solid year. I went out, and I looked, and I looked, and I looked, and I could not find a job. Looking back on that year from hell in my life, I can honestly tell you that I was unemployable. After a year, I was gainfully employed. 5 years later, I was downsized, and I found the job that I have today. I work for an automobile manufacturer, and this is the very best job that I have ever had in my entire life. These people approached me about 8 months ago, and they said, Ellen, I've been there 5 years. They said, Ellen, we are developing a profile of future employees, and we want to know what it is in your life that makes you as good as you are. If we could clone you, we would put a you in every single chair, and we want to find out what that is. And I thought to myself, send them to Al-Anon for 27 years. And you know, is that not a miracle? That happened to me, and I had 18 W-2 forms to attach. That's a miracle, an absolute miracle. And I'm running out of time, and I just want to close by saying that I had the privilege of going to Oregon the year before last, and there was a woman up there that gave me something that I take with me wherever I go. In closing, I want to give this to you also. She said, when you come to the end of all of the light that you have and all of the information that you know, and everything ahead of you is filled with the emptiness and the blackness, know that as you step out, you will step on to solid ground, or you will be given wings and taught how to fly. Thank you, God, for giving me my wings. And thank you, Al-Anon and AA, for teaching me how to fly. I love you all. Happy birthday. And thank you so much for having me. My name is Ellen Torres, and I'm a very grateful member of the Preston Al-Anon Family Group. Thank you.